What's up, podcast listeners? I am so excited to have a dear friend of mine and someone that I just am totally look up to and inspire to be like her, because she is just an incredible person and her story is just amazing. And if y'all want to be real with me, like, let me tell y'all the true Matt Matthews fashion. You know, everything that I do is totally Hot Mess Express. We all know that by now. And so we just recorded this amazing 40-minute podcast and the fucking audio didn't work. So there's me for not checking that. But now we're back, we're good, and we're doing this again for you guys. So I'm so excited to have Danny back on here with us to tell a little bit of her story and her journey into mental health and kind of how she got to the point that she got to today. So welcome, my dear friend, Danny. Thank you so much for being here with us today. So Danny, tell us a little bit of your background and kind of how you got to where you are. I know that you found me through social media and came to do a boudoir shoot with me and start your journey into healing yourself. So kind of tell us what that looks like for you and what the whole journey of mental health kind of looked like and how that started for you.
Yeah. So thanks for having me on your podcast, Matt. I'm really excited to be here. So first, let me start off by saying that, you know, you coming to see you, I think, just kind of helped close the loop or maybe just opened the door into a whole other dimension of my healing journey with my mental health issues. So kind of backtracking into, my history, this goes all the way back to my childhood. I was sexually molested by a family friend, happened when I was about 5 years old. And, it was never something that I ever told my parents. Never told anybody in my family. It was just something that had happened and never, ever talked about it. I honestly never really thought much about it growing up until I had entered into middle school, and an incident had occurred between me and a friend of my parents, where he had made a very inappropriate comment to me. And, in that moment, that kind of triggered what had happened to me in my childhood. And I went to my mom to tell her about the incident that had occurred between me and her friend, and she didn't believe me. And, it was kind of like in that moment, I thought, well, my gosh, if she doesn't believe me that her friend made this inappropriate comment to me, there's no way she's going to believe what happened to me, when I was a kid. So it just never was, it was never mentioned. And to this day, it's never been mentioned. And they have no idea what had happened to me when I was a child. But also, growing up, my mom and her mom never had a really good relationship growing up. And, having gone through, my mental health journey and in talking with my therapist, she had explained to me that, a lot of things that are passed down are kind of generational and, things that occur from parent to child will carry over into the next generation and the next generation and the next generation. So, I kind of see a pattern that, my mom and her mom didn't have a good relationship. And, therefore I think whatever issues that my mom had with her mom kind of spilled over into our relationship growing up. And one of the things that my mom, really rode me hard about growing up was my image, and that I always had to look a certain way and I had to weigh, a certain way. She was constantly on me about my weight. And, when I go back and I look at pictures of myself from my childhood, I was never an overweight child. I was very active. I was, involved in swim team and taekwondo and gymnastics and, you know, dancing, you know, tap, jazz, and ballet. And, you know, I was playing tennis. And, you know, so I was always doing something active. And, you know, it just, I just, you know, don't think I was ever meant to be a really skinny child. And when I was in the seventh grade, my mother put me in Jenny Craig. And from that point on, it was Jenny Craig and diet pills and other kind of, you know, Weight Watchers and, you know, all these other kind of crazy diets. And
which is totally not healthy, I might add, because, baby, I remember doing Weight Watchers as a teenager. And I remember those little, like the ice cream cakes that were like 4 points or 5 points and you couldn't go over your points for the day. Like I did that as a child because I always had, you know, body problems and I always, like I never swam without a shirt as a teenager because I was always self-conscious about my body. Mm-hmm. And like, it just creates such a problem in our minds, and it that in itself is a mental disorder, I feel like, and I still constantly struggle with that. You know, my husband always says that I have body dysmorphia, and mm-hmm. Like I just remember, like, bitch, you cannot go over like 20 points, you know. So like I remember my parents did the Weight Watchers thing, we all did it together, and it was just like just so draining and exhausting, especially as a young person. So like I can't imagine you having to deal with that, you know, at such a young age.
Yeah, and you know, and it's definitely, you know, as I've moved into adulthood, when I see parents today being critical with their children about their weight, it just makes my skin crawl, because just so much of that really does carry on into your adulthood. And you know, I am the middle child of two brothers who have never had to struggle with their weight. I mean, they're just naturally gifted athletes and are just built. I mean, I remember growing up and girls were just swooning over my brothers. And, you know, and I think because of the body shaming that my mom would give me, I never thought of myself as pretty and worthy of boys' attention. And, you know, it always would make me feel very uncomfortable when people would tell me that, you know, I was beautiful and gorgeous. And, you know, and even to this, you know, I wouldn't say to this day, but shortly before I came to see you, it would still make my skin crawl to have people tell me, you know, oh my gosh, you're absolutely gorgeous, you're beautiful. You know, why would you want to, you know, think about changing anything on your body because you are perfect the way that you are. And so that, you know, that was a struggle. And, you know, growing, you know, when I hit my teenage years, even my mom would, you know, constantly be watching the foods that I was eating and telling me that I could have this and I couldn't have that. And, you know, food would be a reward or a punishment. And she would buy things and put them in the pantry and say, you know, these are for your brothers and you're not allowed to have them. And when I was 14 years old, I tried to kill myself for the first time because I just couldn't take the pressure of being just, I guess, under her watchful eye like that, of being, you know, told that, you know, you are basically, you know, overweight and you can't, you know, eat these things. And it was like, they all went out to dinner, like the night that I tried to kill myself. And it was like, I didn't want to go because I knew that she would, you know, we'd all be sitting there and she would make me order a salad and have like, you know, reduced fat dressing or whatever. And, you know, I just didn't want to sit through that. And, you know, so when that had happened, for even to talk about it with my mom, you know, I will say she's got this like narcissistic type personality that, you know, anytime you try to talk to her about something, it's like it never happened. So you never ever get any kind of resolution from her There's never any closure with anything, which is difficult.
So you struggled with these, problems with your mom as a young child, and then you were put on these strict diet plans and struggling already mentally, and attempted suicide for the first time, you said, at 14.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of walk me through what happened after that. Did anything change with your mom? Like, did any relationships change? I mean, that's 14 years old. That's really young to have attempted suicide. Like, what in the world, like, even went through your parents' minds at this time? Were they even, like, trying to help you? What happened after that?
No, nothing changed after that. It was just kind of, like, swept under the rug kind of thing. It was more of me just, I think, being overdramatic. But no, nothing really ever came of it. And, I've always felt like I've had kind of this push and pull, tug of war kind of relationship with my mom. And it's like, she knows exactly what buttons to push to trigger me, but she also knows what to do to pull me in to, kind of manipulate a situation to where I feel like, I need to be dependent on her for something, if that makes sense. It never really got better as I'm, moved, into high school, and I started going through puberty and, body changing, and, it kind of really only got worse. And like I said, I have a body type that I was just never meant to be skinny. I mean, I look at myself and I can say I compare myself to Serena Williams. I mean, that's just how I'm built. I am not a stick thin. I was never meant to have, be like a size zero or anything like that. I realized that even it never mattered how much weight that I lost. I mean, even when I got down to a size 12, it almost was like it still wasn't good enough. I needed to lose more weight. There always was like this push and pull, tug of war kind of thing. And then when I was 19 years old, I was diagnosed with a brain tumor, and I was misdiagnosed 4 times before they actually had discovered what it was.
Wait. So you're going through all of this, trying to commit suicide at 14, struggling with your weight, struggling mentally, and then a brain tumor at 19. How in the hell did that even happen? Like, what even brought that on?
So that, it really happened out of nowhere. I was actually out to dinner with some friends, and we were actually at a Walmart walking through the music section, and I felt like somebody had come up from behind me with an ice pick and stabbed me in the right temple, and the pain just radiated through the whole right side of my head. And I had, I really didn't think much of it when it first happened, but then it was like, the pain wave was coming in increments of like every 2 to 3 minutes. And so I my friend took me home, and I called my mom, who, was working at the hospital at the time. And, I told her what was going on. And so she told my dad to take me to the emergency room near our house. And that first night they were like, she's just a young teenager. No history of headaches. It's just stress of her, with her first year of college and all of that. So here's a couple of painkillers, sent me home, didn't think anything of it. Well, the next day I was feeling worse. So then my mom took me to the emergency room where she worked. And then they did every test in the world you could imagine on me, except check my head. So their assessment was, Oh, well, she just broke up with her boyfriend and she's got allergies and she's also stressed out because it's her first year of college. So here's some more painkillers. Keep a headache diary and follow up with your family doctor. So then we go to the family doctor, but I see the nurse practitioner, and the nurse practitioner is following the recommendations of the ER doctors, which was, you know, allergies, keep a headache diary, and, you know, follow up in a month. And, you know, by the time, you know, we had kind of gone through, so my initial symptom was in May. And then by the time we got through all of this, we were reaching we were getting into early August. And by that point, I was having seizures. I was blacking out. I was having involuntary vomiting. My speech was starting to get impaired. And so my mom had called the family doctor and was like, you know, no offense to the nurse practitioner, but we really want to see the family doctor. And so we saw the doctor, and his first question was, why hasn't anybody checked her head? And so he got me in immediately for a CT scan, and she said she saw the radiologist running into the room, and she knew at that point it wasn't good. And, you know, for everything that I've been through with my mom, I do have to give her credit, because, you know, if she wasn't as persistent as she was, I really would be dead today, because I had a sentinel bleed in my brain, which is what caused the initial symptom. I had two aneurysms in my brain and then the tumor on top of that. And so, you know, I ended up having surgery a month later. And then, you know, just following the whole recovery from all of that, the learning how to talk again, the learning how to walk again, learning just the new normal, because things were much different after that. You know, my hair had fallen out and I had periods of numbness in my head from the radiation treatments. And, you know, just knowing that my memory had been impacted and my speech was going to be forever changed because of that. So just, you know, knowing, you know, kind of remembering how things were before the tumor diagnosis and then how things are after adapting to it, you know, dealing with that was also another curveball into my mental health issues. And then, you know, we, you know, move into college and you go through the whole college experience. And, you know, I didn't really move out of, you know, the house until probably mid-20s, because, you know, I was still under a doctor's care until I was about 23 with everything.
Wow, that is insane to me. So you finally get this, you know, finally get this diagnosis and you have surgery and you're 19 at this point, right?
Mm-hmm. 19.
Okay, so what kind of happens after that? Like, does the relationship with your mom change? Like, what is going on at this point? Because this is a lot for a 19-year-old to go through mentally, physically. Like, this is a lot.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as far as our relationship went, you know, it was almost like things were good for a while, because I think with any parent that goes through a severe illness like that and nearly losing a child, it definitely changes the dynamics of things within the family unit itself. But, you know, as I got older and I had moved, I got back into college because I did have to take a year off, as I was going through my recovery. You know, it was kind of like things just kind of went back to normal. And, you know, we just kind of got back into repetitive patterns again. And, you know, I would just kind of go through these back and forth, you know, periods of where I'd lose weight, gain weight, lose weight, gain weight. And that's really, I've always had that, you know, even today, I still have that lose weight, gain weight. So, you know, really, I think once I got married, you know, I didn't really realize just how, I think, manipulative my mom was. Until my husband started pointing out things. And even then, I didn't really believe him on some things that he was pointing out. And about 5 years ago, I really just got to a point that I think she was really starting to just break me down so bad about so many things, not only just dealing with my weight, but she just started becoming really negative about a lot of things in general, whether it was she was talking bad about people within, you know, my family, or she was just gossiping about people in general. I mean, it really just kind of turned into a very toxic situation. And I remember my husband and I, we were on vacation for our anniversary. And I had just said, you know, I don't think I'm going to go to my parents for Thanksgiving this year because I just don't feel good when I'm around them. And he was fully supportive of that. And when I told her that we weren't coming, you know, she just literally tore me a new one. And I said to her in that moment, you know, I really am just astonished that you are my mother and that you raised me, because you raised me to be better than the way that you are treating me and behaving right now. And, you know, kind of in that same breath, she had said some things and then kind of ended the conversation with, you know, I just can't believe that you're my daughter, and, you know, and hung up. And it was like in that immediate moment, I cut her out of my life, like cold turkey, done. Like I was finished.
So to hear your mother, I mean, of all people, to say, I can't believe you're my daughter. Like, how did that make you feel?
You know, I was so angry with her at that point, and I felt like that was my entire life, essentially, of buildup of anger that I remember telling my husband that I feel like I am never going to be released from her until either she is completely out of my life, whether it's like through this method or, and I know this will sound really heinous, but, or she's dead. Like I felt like she just had that much of a grip on me that I couldn't breathe.
Wow. So at this point, you have cut your mother basically out of your life. And I feel like, you know, I've kind of been there too. I have a half brother and sister, and you know, my entire life, they've struggled with alcohol and, you know, drugs and things like that. And it is, you know, it is a true addiction, and it's something that's really hard to beat. And they still struggle with this. But so much more comes along with that because, you know, you're hurting the people around you that care about you and that do things to you. And I am a firm believer that you can't have a true life of happiness and heal yourself if you're continuing to be hurt. So I believe that cutting people and cutting toxicity out of your life is healthy, you know, and it doesn't matter if it's your parents, if it's your family, whoever it is, if they are bringing toxic into your life and things that shouldn't be into your life that are harming you, then you eventually have to do what's right and what's best for you. So you cut your mom out of your life. So what does that do for the rest of your family?
So, you know, that was kind of the unfortunate part, because there was just like, you know, some casualties that came along with it, because, you know, with cutting my mom out, you know, I lost touch with my dad. And my dad and I we were super close. And, you know, and then I lost touch with my brothers because it was like, you know, I wasn't going to their house for the holidays. So I didn't see, you know, I didn't see my nieces. I didn't see my nephew. I didn't see my brothers at the holidays. So, I mean, I literally went 3 years without talking to anybody in my family. And that even included extended family. I mean, I cut everybody out and it was just me and my husband and, you know, my friends that, you know, I consider part of my family. And it was hard. And that in doing that, it further spiraled my depression. And, you know, that following year, I had attempted suicide again. And, you know, in that moment, you know, my husband had found me and, you know, he didn't know what to do. And, you know, he was panicking and freaking out. And, you know, I was just in this state of, I wasn't cooperating in any capacity. And I told him, you know, I outright was not going to the emergency room. And, you know, and part of that was because, you know, I worked at a hospital and I was like, I didn't want to be seen there. I was so afraid of somebody recognizing me, somebody that I worked with would know who I was. I was afraid of, you know, my medical record being looked at by somebody who I worked with, which, you know, I'm going through catastrophic thinking at that point. And, you know, I went to college for, you know, I got a degree in psychology with an emphasis in counseling. And, you know, I never really wanted to seek help because I felt like I'm just going to go sit in a therapist's office and be asked nothing but a bunch of open-ended questions that I'm not going to have answers to. And I just wasn't ready to deal with that. So, you know, after that event had happened and just seeing the fear on his face, I knew at that point I really did need to seek out help because I know I scared him on a level that I know he will never recover from, and it scares him to this day.
I think, you know, like, there's so many people that struggle with mental health and that struggle with, you know, suicidal thoughts and all these different issues. And I feel like, you know, the biggest part, it's kind of like, you know, alcoholism or drug addiction. Like, the biggest part is admitting that you have a problem and admitting that you need help, you know, knowing that you can't fix this on your own and you have to have someone that can help you. So, mm-hmm. Like, how did that kind of happen for you? What made you, I know you said your husband was really scared, so that kind of made you realize that you needed some other type of help. What did that look like for you?
Yeah, so I think just to back that story up maybe 1 year, you know, when I had cut my family out and he was seeing how it was wearing on me mentally, he actually went and sought help for himself because he just didn't know how to help me. And I think by him going to seek help for himself and learning how to navigate this, I was able to just kind of watch him and see a change with him and kind of just see, you know what, if he's doing okay, then I think my going will be okay. And if he was strong enough to ask for help for me, I should be strong enough to ask for help, not only for me, but for him too. Because I know it was traumatizing for him, what he went through finding me. And so the first step for me was finding a really good therapist, which I did. And so making an appointment, I was able to get in within a matter of days to see the therapist. And, you know, started pretty much unpacking my entire life, which was very hard. But I think in the moment that I decided to get the help too, I was just at a point that I was so tired of crying every single day. I was so tired of being tired and having low energy to no energy and just not feeling like myself and, you know, just having so much noise up in my head that I couldn't think straight. And, you know, even when I would try to find ways to relax or disconnect or preoccupy my mind with everything else, there was just nothing but constant madness and chaos going on in my head. And, you know, it's like, I can understand why people would want to take their lives, because that chaos and madness that goes on in your head, it's just so incredibly loud and it's so incredibly painful. And in that moment, you just want that noise to stop and you just want some level of peace. And you're not thinking about how it's going to impact everybody else around you. You just want the noise to stop. You want the pain to end. And you know, it's suicide is nothing. It doesn't solve anything. It's an end to a temporary situation.
Wow. Like, I love that analogy of it's, you know, it's the end of a temporary situation, because it is. And I think that a lot of people feel like when they have suicidal tendencies, you know, or thoughts that, okay, I'm going to have these, it's going to be terrible forever, you know, and people forget that this will come to pass and things do get better. And, you know, that it doesn't always have to be this bad and this terrible. So what kind of, so you said, you know, you yourself have attempted suicide 2 times now.
Mm-hmm.
So what really brought, you know, to life that, what really kind of taught you that this is temporary, and what kind of helped you overcome that? Cause I know that's really hard mentally to deal with.
Yeah. You know, I will say this first, it is incredibly hard to make that first step to ask for help, because there's such a huge amount of stigma tied to mental health. And, you know, you got to look at it in terms of the brain is a part of your body, and if, you know, you got to treat it as if anything else on your body was hurting, you would go to see the doctor. If you're, you know, you broke your arm, or if your stomach is hurting, or something's wrong with your heart, you would go to the doctor. And you got to start thinking of your brain as, you know, it's a part of your body. If it's hurting, you've got to go get help for it. And it is really a very, very, very difficult step to take. But it is such an important step to take. And I just can't express enough. When you make that step, it's frightening. That first appointment, I can't tell you how overly emotional I was for that first appointment. I was sobbing hysterically. As you unpack everything, you know, you just bring up so many repressed memories. You relive the traumas. But, you know, that's the first step into your healing journey. And, you know, I think, you know, little by little each day, I started to realize I'm going to be okay. I'm in the right hands. I have a good support team. And that's another important part, is you just have to make sure you have a really, really strong support team behind you, because it does kind of take a village to get you through this. And whether that's family, friends, or just a really, really good medical team that's communicating very well amongst one another. And, you know, after, you know, a few weeks of talking with my therapist, you know, she just realized that my issues were more deeply rooted beyond what she could help me with, and really recommended that I seek out a psychiatrist to help me out more with my issues and, you know, get a better diagnosis as to what I'm dealing with, and look at getting on some medication to help find some more balance. And, you know, in talking with her again, that finding that psychiatrist was another hard step for me to take. But again, I had a very good medical team that listened to what I had to say. I made it abundantly clear that I didn't want to see a male psychiatrist because of a lot of the other traumas that I had been through. So they found me a phenomenal female psychiatrist in my hometown that I worked with. And, you know, again, that anytime you go see a new doctor, you know, you gotta unpack everything again and retell your story and relive your traumas. And, you know, but through that, we were able to get a diagnosis of, you know, depression and anxiety and PTSD. And we were able to start the proper medication course to start making me feel better. And I won't say that I'm 100% healed. I don't think you're ever really healed from it. You have your good days, you have your bad days, and you have your really, really bad days. But, you know, I think the important thing is that you maintain your communication with your medical team. And, you know, when you do start to feel like you have those moments of suicidal thoughts, that, you know, you have a trusting enough relationship with your medical team that you can reach out to them and say, hey, I'm not in a good place right now, and I need some help. And, you know, they kind of walk you through that whole situation.
So through all of this time of, you know, healing yourself and doing all these things, you kind of have your family on this time out. And, you know, I think that being able to do that is extremely healthy. You can't heal if you keep pulling the stitches out. So at this point, kind of what happens? Like, what's going on with your mom after all this time? And I mean, have you forgiven her? Do you still not talk to her? What's going on there?
Yeah. So, you know, through the whole healing process, so, you know, I put my family in time out for 3 years. And as we continued to work through getting myself better, which that was the most important thing at TASS, was getting myself better, learning to find peace within myself, learning to love myself. I was able to find forgiveness for the things of my past. And, you know, I laugh and think about, you know, a quote from a Tyler Perry movie that, you know, you have to forgive yourself first and then forgive others in order to move on. And, you know, I was able to be able to work on what a reintegration process looked like with my therapist when I was ready to take that next step to allow my family back into my life. And we were able to work on setting up boundaries. And these are boundaries that nobody in my family is aware of them. And to this day, my family, nobody in my family knows that I'm even, you know, seeking treatment. They have no idea that I had even attempted suicide during that time that, you know, they were in this timeout. But, you know, I have the tools now to know how to de-escalate a situation for myself without making it obvious that I'm removing myself from a situation that I don't want to be a part of. And that has really helped me tremendously because I don't find myself getting pulled in to any kind of manipulation that my mother, you know, can do, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. So what do you really think are the steps, or how do you think people can start to learn to forgive? Because I mean, I know people in my life that are still struggling to this day in adulthood with forgiveness from their parents or their family or whatever the case may be, from things that have happened in their childhood, and it really hinders people's adulthood and, you know, their lives. So what do you think is a good way to start learning to forgive someone?
So, you know, I think for me, I have a very forgiving nature, and that's just me. But I think for anybody, it really serves no purpose to carry a grudge in life and allow hate to just eat at your soul and eat at your heart. I can certainly forgive all day long, but I don't forget. And I think that's probably a really important life lesson for me. I don't dwell on what had happened. I don't want to continue to bring it up. I don't want to bring it up in fighting. But, you know, I can forgive and cut you out of my life, or I can forgive and figure out how to live harmoniously with you, using tools that, you know, I've been taught through, my therapy. And, you know, I think it is just so important to learn to forgive. And really just make that decision of, do you want this person to be a part of your life or not? But another thing too is, you know, if there are toxic people in your life, whether it's friends or family, get that out of your life because it serves no purpose.
Right. I agree with that so much. And, you know, like I said, you can't heal if you keep opening a wound over and over. So tell me, like, where are you today in this mental health journey, especially with, I know the pandemic kind of took a toll on everyone and, you know, all these different things that happened. Where are you today? How are you continuing to, you know, be healthy in this mental health journey? And because I think a lot of people think that mental health is, there's something wrong with you if you have a mental health disorder and there's not, you know what I mean?
Right.
But like people think that if they do have bipolar disorder, if they do suffer with depression, that something's wrong with them. And, you know, it should be something that you don't talk about. And it's just not the case. So where are you today and how are you continuing to stay positive and heal through all of this?
Yeah. So I've learned that it's okay to not be okay. And, you know, now that I'm at a point where I'm feeling a lot more balanced in my life and, you know, I certainly have good days and bad days. I don't ever get away from that, but I do know that every time now that I talk about what I've gone through, I feel like I heal just a little bit more each time I talk about it. And, you know, I hope in talking today that if I can just help one person seek help, and then maybe that one person goes through that healing journey and then they feel open and comfortable enough to talk about it, that, you know, we just kind of have this domino effect that over time it just becomes destigmatized and it's okay to talk about it. You know, but I'll tell you, the pandemic has been hard. I'm not going to lie. I'm a social person. So to be completely cut off, I mean, it felt like a death last year. you know, just in one day, everything came to a halt. And I know it felt that way for most everybody. And, you know, to be confined to a house, to my house, to have my husband be home and we both be working from home together. It's a miracle that we are still married.
Baby, same.
And I would tell him I was all about having a retired life with him. I just wasn't ready to experience that retired type life right now, especially working a full-time job and it be kind of a high-stress job at the same time. So, you know, the pandemic has definitely stressed my mental health. You know, I did go through another period of having another suicidal type moment last year, and I'll tell you that that moment was probably by far the worst one I've had yet. And that one landed me in the ER. And I'll tell you, to go to the ER during a pandemic was so beyond frightening because of the changes now with COVID. Your caretaker can't go back there with you. And so, you know, not only are you placed in a holding room for mental health people, but you're there alone. You're stripped of everything that you own and have, and you've got a person watching you outside of this room. And, you know, because you've got the social distancing rule in place, there's nobody there who can comfort you when you're just emotionally unhinged. And, you know, to be told that you're going to be transferred to a mental health hospital and I can't contact my husband because they've, again, taken all of my belongings with me. You know, that's something that's not talked about. And, you know, that was something that I wasn't prepared to deal with. To go through that journey. And, you know, you're already at your lowest point when you're going through, you know, that level of a breakdown, and then to have no caretaker, no comforting means, you know, I sat there and I was just like, how in the world did my life just end up like this? Like how? And, you know, again, I have to credit my medical team because, you know, they swooped in. I mean, I was in the emergency room for about 7.5 hours, before I was actually, released to go home. And, I was so thankful that they didn't have to transfer me to a mental health facility. My psychiatrist was actually able to get on the phone with the emergency room doctor. And I will say in that moment that happened, there was some medication changes that were going on. And, you know, again, I can't stress enough that if you begin a journey of going through seeking professional help and getting on medication, it's imperative that you stay on that journey. Don't, you know, keep up with your doctor's appointments. Make sure you're staying on your medications. Make sure you're communicating with your doctor if you're, you know, if anything feels off, because it's incredible how quickly, when you make a slight change to your medication, how quickly things can change. So, you know, we made some very abrupt changes to my medication within the next 48 hours following that episode. And, you know, I'm definitely in a much healthier, more sane place today, and can actually manage dealing with the pandemic a lot better now than what I was in the earlier stages of it last year.
So, Dani, if you could tell our listeners today one thing, whether they are struggling with mental health, whether they are having suicidal tendencies or whatever else that's going on in their life, what is something that you would tell them?
That you're not alone. There are so many resources out there that can, that are available to help you. Don't be afraid to ask for help, and don't continue to sit in silence and allow your pain to control your life. And there are more people out there that care about you and want you to be here tomorrow than you can even imagine. So I would just say that first step in admitting that you need the help is the hardest step to take. But once you do take that first step, it's amazing how freeing you start to feel after you take that step. And, it was after I took that initial first step, it really was by a happy accident that I found you on social media. I don't even know how I came across you, but it was like you just kind of popped up on my feed through another boudoir photographer's page. And there was just something about the way she captured you in a photo that made me want to click on your profile to kind of learn more about you. And so then I started following you at that point, really not ever in a million years thinking that I would ever do boudoir photo shoot, knowing how much of a body image problem I had. But honestly, I think I'd only been following you for maybe about 6 months when I was just like, fuck it, I got to do it. It's kind of like, and now, I just have to do it. I mean, there was just something about you that I didn't even know you. I had never texted with you, never communicated with you, but I felt this connection to you that I was like, I got to do this. And so I was like, I made the call. I set up the appointment. I was like, I have to do this night shoot. And I showed up and, I can't even describe, like, I was so freaking nervous to even do, like, when I did this, like, I was so freaking nervous to do this. And I think after we did like the first shot, I started to calm down a little bit, but I'll be honest with you, honey, I took a Xanax before I started even the first shot with you. But, it was kind of like the more pictures we took, the more outfits I changed into, I started to just kind of relax a little bit more. Half of it was the Xanax. But, when I went back to the hotel room that night and you kind of sent me that first picture to look at, I looked at it and I was like, holy shit, I cannot believe that's me. And it was almost like in that moment, I felt like I saw myself as the woman that I was. And I think what people saw versus what I thought of myself as unbeautiful, unattractive, unwanted kind of thing. And there really truly just aren't enough words to describe how much that session with you forever has changed my life. I mean, because even on my most down days following that session, I haven't lost touch or lost sight of the fact that I'm a badass bitch.
Period.
I look fucking amazing.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, I have enjoyed, you know, both times that I've got to photograph you. I've, you know, thoroughly loved working with you. I have loved hearing your journey. I've loved your openness about mental health and your struggles. And, you know, that is just such an inspiration to me and to other people I know. And I'm just so proud of you and the person that you've become. And I'm forever grateful for you being willing to share your story. I know that's a hard story to share and, you know, putting that out there for the world to hear. But, you know, it all starts with one person being willing to share, and like you said, the domino effect just kind of happening. So thank you so much for being willing to share and coming onto the podcast with me and, you know, helping to bring awareness to mental health and maybe changing someone else's life by hearing this. So thank you so, so much, Danny, for being a part of this. I can't thank you enough. I know that the fans and the listeners are going to be super excited to hear this one. And you're amazing. And I can't wait to continue to be a part of your healing journey and to see more of your journey as you continue on. Cause this is, you know, this is not nowhere near the end, but it is such a step in the right direction. And I'm just super proud of you. And thank you so much for being a part of this with me.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Matt. And you just continue to do what you're doing. Cause I know that you make the difference in so many women's lives. And I'm forever grateful that whatever the universe did that day to connect us, I'm forever grateful. So
I am too. So again, thank you so much. And if you are struggling with mental health or suicidal tendencies, please know that you are not alone. There are people out there. There are people willing to help you. And there are so many different resources for you to reach out to. So please never think that you're alone in this situation and always reach out for help if you are struggling with any of these issues. Thank you.